This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender community. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Polinsky.
Jennifer Renee.
J.D. Doyle.
Greg Chapman.
And Glenn Holt.
Well, and this is the Pride edition of Queer Voices.
I'm proud.
Yes, well, we all have lots of pride tonight. I'm very excited that our first interview is going to be...
It's going to be Sergeant Oliver, Julia Oliver, the police sergeant who is transitioning on the job and finding great support within the city, the police union, and the police department.
We've come a long way.
We have.
Then we're going to be interviewing both Phyllis Fry, the female grand marshal, and Ray Ramirez, who's a male grand marshal, talking all about Pride. In the second hour, Carol Wyatt, who is the vice president of Pride Houston, will be sort of giving us a total overview of what's been going on the past year. Then our friend Joan talks to the authors of American Queer Now and Then. So it's a lot of Pride stuff this week, and we'll get right to it. Well, we will get right to it. But first, we have some music.
We do?
We do. I'm sorry. I thought we were going to have music so that we can transition. But...
Well, I just spent 10 days in New York covering the Out Music Awards, and I brought some music back with me.
Good. And you're going to be playing it this evening?
I'm going to try and sneak some in. Glenn, if the Jen Foster CD has a track called Underdogs, and that CD, or that song won the Out Music Awards Out Song of the Year. And that, there were like 10 finalists for that awards, for that category. All top-notch music, very lyrically gay stuff. This song I'm particularly pleased with. It's a very powerful song. It's her second win. A couple years ago, she won a female recording.
What's it called?
The Underdogs. It's the track, title track.
Oh, track three. Okay.
He's queuing that up as we speak.
Yes. Well, because we changed our format a little bit, it's and I've been away for a little while, so it's a little rusty for me.
We've missed you.
You have?
Absolutely. Well, check out the lyrics of this song. It's very powerful. Glenn?
Second grade, Billy Sims, playing out by the jungle gym. All the boys laughed at him for some sort of speech impediment. And they knocked him down, and I pushed them off, and they kicked our asses, 'cause we were the underdogs. Second grade,
That was the title cut from Jenny Foster's new CD, The Underdogs.
Okay. Good evening. I'm Jennifer Renee.
And Greg Chapman.
Guest tonight is Julia Oliver. She's a sergeant with the Houston Police Department. And if I'm mistaken, the first transgender ever to transition on the force. Welcome, Julia.
Good evening.
That is correct?
As far as I know, when I first notified the police department, I asked, and as far as they knew, they'd never had somebody who actually transitioned on duty. Not with Houston, at least.
Well, first of all, some basics. Where are you from? Are you originally from Houston?
I was born and raised here, St. Joe's. I'm actually one of the few rare Houstonians in this city.
A native
Houstonian.
Oh, my God. You're a vanishing breed, almost.
I think so.
There's actually two in this room, because I'm one of them.
Yes, and I'm a carpetbagger. I couldn't be transgendered and live in Beaumont, Texas very long.
Well, my parents were actually from Ohio, so they moved down here just before I was born. So I've always said I have a Southern who hit Yankees for parents.
Well, we won't hold that against them. Did you go to... Yeah, obviously, you went to school here in Houston.
Yes.
Where'd you go to school?
Went to Melby as a senior high, and Dee Dee when I was in junior high.
Well, first of all, you're planning to go through the complete gender correction? Is that
yes.
the way I understand?
Yes, ma'am.
And so how long have you been aware of your feelings?
Well, I think when I was very young, three or four years old, I just never realized there was a difference between boys and girls. That's how I felt. You get told you can't act a certain way, and rather than get hit, you stop acting that way. But I just, for most of my life, or early life, I didn't think much about being a boy or a girl. As you got older and you tried to do what people told you or to act the way you're supposed to, you try to bury those feelings and be what they keep telling you to do. And that's what I did eventually.
That I do understand. Were you active in sports? I mean, I was, and I'm just wondering if that follows suit.
I was, but I wasn't very good about it.
Oh.
I tried, but no. I played football, I played basketball, and I ran track.
Oh.
And then I got into music, and I did that for the last several years I was in high school.
What music? What sort?
I was in the choir, and then I was in several plays.
Oh.
I was just curious if there was a particular event or something that occurred that caused those feelings you had buried as you were young to bubble up.
Well, the catalyst of what made me finally decide to deal with it or start to deal with it occurred about 19 years ago. I was involved in a shooting, on-duty shooting, in which the individual almost killed me. And trying to deal with that, I had finally reached a point where I had proven I was a man and didn't really think I had to prove it anymore, and stopped trying to suppress the feelings. And I think that's where a lot of it started, is starting to allow those feelings back into my life and stop trying to repress them.
Were you married at the time?
Yes, I was married for 27 years until the divorce.
And how long ago was that?
Divorce was about 3 years ago.
So you really started moving forward in your transition 3 years ago after the divorce or prior to it?
I started exploring it, and it was the catalyst to a lot of the problems in the end of the marriage some years back. I came out and tried to talk to my ex-wife. Of course, trying to explain it to her in those days was very difficult because I had no information on it and didn't know how to explain what I was feeling. Rightly so. Her comments during the divorce itself was that she thought she married a man and she didn't feel like being in a lesbian relationship, and that's what she felt like she was with me. So she wanted to move on with her life, and I've not begrudged her that. I understand that she married something that was a facade, it was something that I put up to the world, but not how I actually felt. So she had, I thought she had the right to find somebody that made her happy.
If it's any consolation, I have two like that. So, at least you stopped with the first one.
How is your relationship now with your ex-wife, or do you have one at all? Or?
Lord, no.
No.
How about your children, though? I know that you have, now, if I got this right, 5 children?
I have 5 grown children.
Okay, yes. What age?
The eldest is 30 and the youngest is 18.
Oh, going off to college or in college?
The two oldest have finished college.
No, I'm talking about the youngest today.
The youngest one is supposed to go to college to get into film editing. That seems to be his passion. My daughter was going to school to be a doctor, and she just moved to Colorado this year with her boyfriend and is taking the semester off while they get settled in up there, but she's supposed to start back.
Well, how are they feeling about this?
They were coming to terms and dealing with it. They just didn't want to really talk about it at this point. When this hit the news media, I have not heard from them, any of my children, really, mm-hmm. since that occurred. The two that live with me now avoid the subject, and I have respected their wishes to not deal with it right now and give them the time and the space to come to terms with it.
No, you're just going to come on a radio and talk about it, right? Well, I understand that. I have a couple of siblings that don't want to talk to me anymore after I came out.
I haven't heard from any of my brothers and sisters since it hit the news.
How many brothers and sisters do you have?
I have 2 brothers and 2 sisters.
So has anyone in any part of your extended family?
No.
No?
No, they're... I called, as I knew this was coming out, I called them first rather than them have find out through the media and talk to each of them. One of my sisters, it was originally very supportive, but I think all the news media has probably made it a little harder for her. My 2 brothers, I understand, wanted to think about it. My little sister was extremely against it. For religious reasons. Mm. So, but since it hit the news, no, I have not heard from any of them.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. But I feel you. I had that happen to me. And, I think as transgenders, that's one of the things we have to know to deal with. That, mm-hmm. And we're told that at some point, you may lose your entire family. They may not speak to you ever again. So mm-hmm. it's a tough road, a tough decision. It's courageous. I honor you about that. Now, what about support from your community, in the sense that the police department, the police chief, I know that you've had a whole lot of support. Tell us about it.
I first told Captain Williams on the 20th of last month, and as soon as I finished telling him what I was going through. He immediately advised me that he would support and help and asked what he could do to help me in any way.
Now, if I understand, there is a procedure within the police department for transitioning?
Not that I'm aware of, and I don't think they were aware of it either.
Okay, well, I was just checking.
They've, as I understand it, started putting one in place as a result of me.
Oh, well, someone has to be first.
Like I said, I spoke to him, and he was very supportive. He's helped make the notifications to the chain of command. That week, I went down and I talked to one of our units that deals with discrimination and sexual harassment. Gave them some literature on transsexuals and transitioning with police departments by a doctor who had done research for several years with a number of police departments that's already had officers who have transitioned. And then I gave the official notification to my lieutenant that Friday with a number with that information. As I understand it, from there, during that week, the command staff and the lawyers and everybody were already starting to look at policies and procedures and what they needed to do. They've spoken to my doctor, who's Dr. Cole in Galveston and Roseburg Clinic, and they have worked with him as far as being able to structure what the procedures and what the transition will be, and to follow a lot of what he's telling them is what I need to go through and deal with during the next year or so as I transition.
Now, I understand you've gotten support, one from the GLBT community,
yes.
Your captain and the chief of police. Did you get a letter from the police?
I haven't gotten a letter, but he has sent through the command staff and through my captain the department will support and provide what help and assistance they can through this time.
Okay.
For this transition. I understand through the same way that Mayor White has also advised that he would like to have the support in the department to provide the support that I need during this time. But I haven't spoke to them individually yet.
Okay. Well, and the police union is in full support.
Yes, the union president and I spoke. He's to flat out said, I don't understand what you're going through, and I have no real personal feelings about it. But you are a member of our department. You're a member of this union, and we will support you, provide all the support that we can. Through this time, so yes.
We just have a couple of seconds left. Is there anything you want to say that you've been holding back? Want to say that
I want to
tell people?
I want to know what you're feeling through all this.
Well, I had planned to wait a little while before I started all this, so it's a little overwhelming. It's the main thing I keep feeling is just dealing with all of it at one time and trying to get back to doing my job and being able to show that I'm qualified and capable of doing the job I do, and to let this process have its natural course and get to that point where I can make that transition, which I really am anxious to do. I just need to let it work like it's supposed to.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Our guest tonight has been Julia Oliver, Sergeant Oliver with the Houston Police Department. Our best wishes and good luck on your transitioning. I'm Jennifer Renee. This is Queer Voices.
I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending June 17, 2006. We reported last week about the Australian federal government's intention to disallow the newly enacted civil unions law in the Australian Capital Territory, or ACT, which includes the nation's capital, Canberra. Much like the U.S. Congress can override laws passed by the Washington, D.C. City Council. It was a race to see if the ACT's move to fast-track the process would permit any gay and lesbian couples to civilly unite under the territory's new law before the government of Prime Minister John Howard could stop them. Governor General Michael Jeffrey ignored pleas from ACT government officials and decided to back the federal government, officially overturning the territory's Civil Unions Act late this week after meeting with Attorney General Philip Ruddock. Except for the territory's Liberal Party senators' vote against his own government, the first time that's happened since Howard took office 10 years ago, the tally to disallow the Governor General's disallowance was otherwise along party lines. While the Labor-led opposition was unable to muster a majority, the final Senate vote was a razor-thin 32-30 to uphold the federal override. "There are issues that remain responsibilities of the Commonwealth, and marriage is one of them," said Ruddock. He accused the territory's government of intentionally crafting the Civil Unions Act to make it as close as possible to marriage. But ACT Attorney General Simon Corbell called the federal government's intervention homophobic, arrogant, and undemocratic. "We made 63 amendments in response to the Commonwealth's initial complaint," he said. But Mr. Ruddock refused last week to identify which clauses remained unacceptable. Corbell promised new legislation for same-gender couples in the ACT, saying, "It's still our intention to give the same level of recognition provided for in the Civil Unions Act."
A British lesbian couple legally married in Canada has argued for full legal recognition of their marriage in Britain's High Court. Sue Wilkinson and Celia Kitzinger, two university professors who married almost 3 years ago in British Columbia, cited the Human Rights Act in their lawsuit, which prohibits discrimination and guarantees the right to privacy and family life. They call it insulting and discriminatory to be offered the lesser status of a civil partnership under new UK legislation passed late last year. Sir Mark Potter of the High Court's Family Division presided over the three-day hearing and said it may be a few weeks before he issues a ruling. Other foreign national same-gender couples married in Canada are demanding legal recognition of their marriages, with lawsuits pending in Ireland, Israel, New Zealand, and Hong Kong.
A Ugandan lesbian living in the UK was sent back to Entebbe this week after being told by a British immigration judge that she was not entitled to asylum because lesbians are not homosexuals and that only gay men in Uganda face persecution. When Elizabeth Muwezi lived in Uganda, according to the British rights group Outrage, she was kidnapped from her home soon after visiting an underground gay club and held for 5 months at a so-called safe house, where she was raped and beaten. Before she was deported, Muwezi said in a statement, "I fled to the UK hoping for protection. I am terrified of what will happen to me."
7 men in Cameroon, whose offense was being at a gay-friendly nightclub in the capital city of Yaoundé last year, have been retried and found guilty of sodomy, according to a report issued this week by the San Francisco-based International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, or IGLHRC. They were each sentenced to 10-month jail terms. 2 others were acquitted. The men have been locked up since their arrests in May 2005, so the rights group hopes they'll be released soon for time served. 11 men had been incarcerated following the raid. 2 of them were released shortly before the original trial began in April. The remaining 9 were acquitted by a reluctant trial court judge because a disorganized prosecution failed to present any witnesses, but Cameroon authorities ordered a retrial. Homosexuality per se is not a crime in the West African nation, and a sodomy conviction requires being apprehended or witnessed in the act. "One wonders on what basis the convictions were made," said IGLHRC Executive Director Paula Edelbrick, "as there was no evidence presented by the prosecution of the commission of sodomy. Though they may be leaving prison, they do so under a cloud and with their lives in tatters." Anti-queer hostility in Cameroon has escalated since 3 tabloids published sensationalized front-page lists earlier this year of high-profile citizens they claimed are gay.
But Hawaii will be dishing out $625,000 to settle a federal civil rights lawsuit filed by the American Civil Liberties Union against the U.S. state's youth correctional facility. A judge agreed in February that the lockup was in a state of chaos, characterized by dangerous and pervasive harassment against LGBT youth. He cited threats of violence, physical and sexual assault, imposed social isolation, and near constant use of homophobic slurs in his ruling. The ACLU sued on behalf of three wards, a transgender 17-year-old girl, an 18-year-old lesbian, and an 18-year-old young man perceived to be gay. Part of the settlement, to be split among the plaintiffs and their lawyers, will pay for a court-ordered consultant to help draft new policies, train staffers, and set up a grievance system at the facility. Lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender young people are often abandoned by their families and end up on the streets, said Lois Perrin, legal director of the ACLU Hawaii. Those who end up in state care should be rehabilitated, nurtured, and fostered, whether they're gay or straight, she added, not singled out for cruelty and mistreatment because of who they are.
Two presumably heterosexual men in England were sentenced to life in prison this week after earlier pleading guilty to the brutal bashing death of popular gay bar manager Jody Dobrowski. Shouting anti-gay slurs, Thomas Pickford and Scott Walker ferociously beat the 24-year-old Dobrowski to a pulp last October as he walked through London's Clapham Common after spending an evening with friends. The assault disfigured him so badly that fingerprinting was required to make a positive identification of the body. The judge said that under the terms of his sentences, the two men will each spend at least 28 years behind bars. Sherry Dobrowski called her son's death an act of terrorism. In a free and democratic society, the family said in a statement, Jody's murder was an outrage.
Four young men in New York City each face up to 25 years in prison for their vicious, hate-fueled beating of well-known performer Kevin Aviance during the early morning hours of June 10th. Ranging in age from 16 to 20, they were charged this week with first-degree gang assault and first-degree assault as a hate crime. According to felony complaints filed by prosecutors, the four followed Aviance as he walked through the East Village, yelling anti-gay epithets before surrounding and beating him. He suffered a broken jaw, a bruised knee, and other injuries. Aviance is recovering following surgery and 2 days in the hospital, his leg in a brace and his jaw wired shut, but he vows to sing as scheduled on the New York City Pride Day stage later this month. Aviance, who performs in drag, topped the Billboard dance music charts in 2002 in 2004 with his songs Give It Up and Alive. If nothing else, he said in a statement about the attack, I hope it brings more awareness.
The main suspect in the brutal assault on two gay U.S. broadcast journalists vacationing in April on the Caribbean island of Saint Martin surrendered to police this week. The man, identified only as Duracell, has denied beating CBS employees Dick Jefferson and Ryan Smith with a tire iron during the attack. But according to a report by the Associated Press, three others already arrested for participating in the crime have made statements to police naming him as the primary assailant. Under Saint Martin law, the names of suspects are not released until trial. The beatings occurred in the Dutch portion of Saint Martin, but the four suspects were living on the island's French side, reportedly making their arrests more difficult. Smith suffered the more serious injuries of the two men. He required brain surgery, and a portion of his shattered skull had to be replaced with a titanium plate. He told the Miami Herald that news of the latest arrests was wonderful, saying, "What we all wanted was for this crime not to go unpunished."
And finally, in case you're wondering how Mary Cheney's new book is doing, the U.S. Vice President's much-maligned lesbian daughter and Bush apologist would be well-advised to take the money and run. According to a story in The Advocate, despite wide media coverage when it was published in May, Now It's My Turn has bombed at the bookstores. Nielsen BookScan reports that Mary's memoir has attracted barely 6,000 buyers. Sales dropped in each of the 4 weeks following its release, with a paltry 574 copies purchased during the week ending June 3rd. At that rate, publisher Simon & Schuster will never come close to recouping the reported million-dollar advance it paid Cheney for the book.
That's News Wrap for the week ending June 17, 2006. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
This is Queer Voices.
Well, I've been away for a little while because of a number of different things, and mostly because of Pride. I've been so busy in the office that luckily everybody else here has been able to take over and do a fabulous job. But because this is the week before the major event, the Pride and the Parade and the Festival, I've come back, and we've really sort of focused this show on Pride this week. And under full disclosure, you should know that I'm Executive Director of Pride Houston, which is a paid position, but I'm also very much involved in this radio show, but Pride is very much part of the community. With me this evening are two long-time activists, and I say that very, very fondly, Phyllis Fry and Ray Ramirez, mm-hmm. who, and I should let you know that how Grand Marshals are selected, it is selected by the community at large. Anybody who lives in Harris or surrounding counties can come and vote during four different sessions that we had early in February in that time of year, and so it's a popular vote. And I am very proud, though, that many times most of the times the popular vote works out and just picks people recognize the contributions that people have done within our community. And both Phyllis and Ray have been around the community for many years, and I don't mean that as I mean around that doing things, being very much involved. And Ray, why don't you give us a little bit of a background of some of the things you did? And certainly I know some of the things you did because you were very much involved in Pride for a number of years.
Well, I really started getting involved in Pride in 84. Not in Pride, but just started in the community by little things like forming the skating club, which the other Colt 45s and MCCR had dropped out because they couldn't sell liquor. And I was wanting to skate and wanted to have something outside of the clubs, you know, just a wholesome atmosphere. And so I did that, and that catapulted me to the Pride Committee, and then we went skating the Pride Parade, and that then I had to go to two meetings to join the Pride Committee. From then, it was serving on every board there and all the committees, you know, the raising money for fireworks money, raising money for everything. And I got some of the HIV doctors and other doctors to donate money and fund this. And then, of course, my intimate connection with Budweiser has led to a bond that I wouldn't give it away for anything. And then to do things globally at InterPride and Gay Games in 94 is just part of the things I've done. And now I'm a member of MCC, and I chair two anniversary celebrations there. And it is just fantastic. And two years ago, I went to Monterey representing my church and this region, which is North and South America. So I do things globally.
Well, and you're also involved in the film festival.
Yes, I am. Uh-huh. Board member on that. And last year I was the past PR chief for that. So it never stops. But another thing, Jack, that I want everybody to know, to never forget the females for taking up the banner when the HIV struck. Many, many times we forget to say thank you to our female counterparts for taking up the executive director and presidents of the caucus and all the national organizations, because HIV had taken many of our friends from us.
Well, and I think there's a number of organizations within the community that females have led the organization through some really tough times. Mm-hmm. Sue Lovell was president of the caucus,
right,
during the 84 referendum,
mm-hmm.
and Eunice Parker, of course, and,
yeah,
and so many other, especially that time when we were so preoccupied with other things, and including giving blood.
Oh,
I
yes.
mean, we weren't allowed to give blood, so a lot of women did that.
Mm-hmm.
Phyllis,
yes.
Where do we start? Phyllis has been involved in the community way before I got involved here, and I didn't really know some of the history until not too long ago that you really were a trailblazer in many ways.
Well, thank you very much. I began in the fall of 1975 here in Houston when I joined the Resurrection Metropolitan Community Church, sang in their choir, went to church, my spouse, and I found a home there. And then as I began to transition, I began to lobby against the cross-dressing ordinance, and that is a very important ordinance because it was repealed legislatively 26 years ago. But prior to that time, the Houston Police Department used to come into the lesbian bars and arrest women who were wearing fly front pants.
Now that mm-hmm. is just so incomprehensible right now, this year.
But
that's what happened.
And last year when I gave this same speech to some of the workers for last year's Pride Festival, there were quite a few older, and when I say older, I'm talking about my age because I'm 55, some of them in their mid-60s, older women that were there, and they said, oh yeah, I remember that. Oh yeah, mm-hmm. I remember that. Our bars used to be raided frequently, and the gay bars, wherever there was any type of a drag performance, if someone left the performance area still in costume and came into the bar area, they were arrested.
Incredible.
And so there was a lot of arrests going on. And I got rid of that law 26 years ago. Then I went to law school, and I started practicing down at the courthouse, Harris County Courthouse, openly in 1986. And there was a lot of gay and lesbian lawyers down there, but they were all closeted. And after a couple of years of winning trials and winning respect, a lot of them started coming out because they figured, well, if Phyllis can do it, we certainly can do it. So there was a huge opening down at the courthouse.
Well, and to that point, I don't know if people understand nowadays, but sometimes our own people were our worst enemies. And certainly Ray talks about this. But for example, in the early days of Pride, when we used to call the radio and TV stations and, you know, let them know about the story and stuff, if that person was a gatekeeper, the assignment editor happened to be a gay or lesbian, more than likely they'd never pitch that story to their superiors because they might be found out as gay. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure the same thing happened with the lawyers and within the community.
Absolutely. And you know, that was just an ongoing theme. But, you know, now I am very well accepted in, throughout the state, in the state bar. And I helped Mitchell Quatine and others to form the Sexual Orientation and Gender Identification Issues section of the State Bar in Texas. And I was a founder of what has now become the Stonewall Lawyers of the Greater Houston Area and many other legal organizations. I've been very fortunate to have written a lot of law review articles. And if anyone wants to see some of the stuff that I've done, you need only go to TG Legal. It's one word, tglegal.com, or you can go to my firm's website, of which I'm a partner, and that's nsflaw.us, or you can just Google my name.
Wow. Well, quite a history between both of you who've been involved, and certainly in the early days when Pride was pretty much part of other organizations. I mean, now we're sort of on our own. But we used to say, and Ray said this a lot, Ray Hill said this, is that there's pretty much five activists in the community. We all just, you know, changed hats when it was time season to do something else.
Oh, yeah. I remember when I first came out, there was only four of us, and transgenders, and one was a convicted felon, and one had a raccoon, and I've forgotten who the other one was, but that was us. You know, whenever there's any transgender news, it was the four of us. Uh-huh. And yet now there's so many transgenders out. You know, the president of the political caucus is an open and out transgender. We have so many transgender organizations now in Houston that we have a Unity organization, which has had its 13th annual Unity banquet this last April. And it's really an exciting time. I don't have to go to the universities and speak anymore. I don't have to go this and speak anymore. I don't have to do this. So many of my other transgender sisters and brothers are either covering it or have integrated and taken our rightful place, which we established at the Stonewall Rebellion in 1969, as being part of the greater gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender community.
And Ray, the Hispanic community,
of course,
which you help integrate into the overall GLBT community.
I certainly did.
And, I mean, there's still lots of room and lots of work that has to be done.
For sure.
Both sides of the issue.
Mm-hmm.
But you definitely try to get more people involved in the community.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I also, Jack, want to relate to you that, you know, I was on Bunnies for 17 years on that board, and I was a second-year member, and it's like in its 26th year today, and I named it Bunnies on the Bayou. And
from what it used to be called?
Yes, Bunny something
which we,
else.
Which we can't say here on the
Bunny
radio.
Bunny something else. And I've also been, I helped the two Eleanors one day were founding Bearing Omega and the Frost Eye Clinic and the Bearing Clinic also. And I've run in many AIDS walks, fun runs, and things like that with Sarah Seiler. And it's just amazing to survive it and see now this. And also, I'm the founder of the Banner District on Westheimer. I remember when we went before city council, and as I exited, it was, you know, they tagged it 1 week for legal purposes. And then the next week, we got a full vote, and Sandy Stone said, Ray, you need to run for something, because they never get a unanimous vote for anything in this council
right,
chamber.
And Ray is referring to the Lower Westheimer Banner District, which is part of Pride, that every year we put up the rainbow flags, which probably next year we need to replace the flags, but we're working on that. And it's interesting, though, that what we have done in Pride is the fact that we follow the rules, that the flags go up, they come down by the rules, and so we're treated very, you know, that we do everything the way they're supposed to be. We follow the rules. What do you think? What drives you to do these things?
My background is my family, my friends, things like that. And when you see a void, like you say, in the minority community, there's someone has got to be a leader and take it, you know, and I did it for a long time, and I will continue to do it. I'm probably going to look for a political run in 09 or 10 for a city seat. You know, I've done the demographics and the statistics look very good. So it's time for a gay man. And Jack, you know that at least 10 gay men have run for city council, and they have not one, and it's time for a gay man,
and this is something that the women are leaders on, because we have both Sue Lovell and Elise Parker elected citywide, no less.
Exactly.
We're talking to Ray Ramirez, who is the male grand marshal, and of course Phyllis Fry, who's a female grand marshal. Phyllis, what drives you?
Well, I was listening to Sergeant Oliver talk earlier, and although our stories are not the same in many ways, they are in that I tried to do everything I could to deny the woman that was inside of me for all those years.
And you had some real tough times financially.
Well,
right?
We had 10 years, my spouse and I, and we're going to celebrate our 33rd anniversary next week. My spouse and I stayed together, and it was so bad that between 1976 and 1986, we turned off our air conditioner because it was just something that we couldn't afford. And in Houston, Texas, to go 10 summers without your air conditioner is quite a sacrifice.
Yes.
But I could not, I went through so much that I could not open the door for myself and let it close on others. And so every time I've either opened a door or had a door open for me, I've ensured that before I left that door, it was ripped completely off the hinges so that other people would not have difficulty going through that same door. Because, you know, I've been given gifts, and I need to use them.
And one of the things you said is that usually when a person transitions, they go back into the community. They don't go into the community. They go back into their life, and they're not activists. What do you think has changed in the recent years that there are more transgender persons who are also activists?
Well, I think it's the sheer numbers, because most people, whether they're transgender, GLBT, or straight, or whoever they are, most people are shy. Most people do their jobs, they go home, and they live their lives. But there's always a certain percentage, and I don't know what it is, of people who are active and who are interested. And because there's more and more and more transgenders that are coming out, we're getting that percentage now of people who are sticking. The common phrase in the transgender community is that, unfortunately, a lot of people use the community to go from one closet to another. But because it is becoming easier, as in the case of Sergeant Oliver. It wasn't easy for her to open up the door on Friday morning, have a television camera stuck in her face like she was some type of a thief or something like that. She didn't do anything except go through channels. Okay? But the point is that we then, my law firm, held a press conference 5 days later. And we introduced the press to Julia. And we said, okay, if you got a question, ask it. Okay, if you got a question, ask it. And we sat there and we let them ask every question they could ask. And when it was all over with, we were such a non-issue that Inside Edition, who had wanted us, didn't want us. Good Morning America, who had wanted us, didn't want us. Dateline, who'd wanted us, didn't want us, because there was no controversy. Well, happy days. Isn't that great? And she is going to be able to, the best I've been able to determine, keep her job. And she told me, you know, that in the last 2 years, 4 other transgendered HPD officers that she knew of left the department rather than transition. Mm-hmm. That's 4 officers that HPD is less, that the city of Houston is less, who could be guarding the city of Houston while we're having a shortage of officers. And so I am so proud of Julia Oliver, and I'm very proud of the city of Houston Police Department, and I'm very proud of the mayor's office, and I'm very proud of Ann Clutterbuck's office, because she is the District C council member over the Fondren police storefront. And so, you know, you put all this together, and it's a very exciting time. And just as if Phyllis could do it down at the courthouse, now I can say Sergeant Oliver can do it down at HPD. All of you who are listening who are still sitting in your closets, why? You know, you're just wasting your life sitting in the closet.
Well, the other week I was listening to Jesse Jackson's show, which is buried on a Sunday morning on KPRC radio when all the other right-wing shows are played in prime time while people are driving to and from work. But somebody called and said they were fired or they were having some problems. I think it was discrimination. And Jesse turned to on the air. He said, are you a member of any civil rights organization? Mm-hmm. And the person said, no.
Why
and,
not?
And both of you, three of us actually, are members of political organizations or have been or mm-hmm. will be over the lifetime of dealing with things. And whether it's a Democratic Party or the caucus or HRC, the Human Rights Campaign, or many other ones, how else are we going to move forward unless we support our own organizations who are supporting the change, social change, and things that need to be done? You're listening to KPFT. This is an activist radio station. And the same thing is that I push everybody to get involved. And as you know, and Ray used to say this wonderful story when Larry Bonnerice used to complain about what Ray was doing at Pride. Larry's Ray says, "Come on, help change it, help make
that's
us
right.
you know
that's right.
better." And that's how all of our organizations, because somebody gets mad, somebody is not liking what's being done. Now it's really easy to criticize from the side street and say this is mm-hmm. being done right, but actually get into that organization. And most of our organizations are open and willing. And sometimes we're a little bit set in our ways, but you know, you get into our face enough, and if you're going to actually get involved, we're all saying welcome. You know,
right.
I mean, this radio show, I'm stepping back more because we got more people involved who are really good at it and passionate.
Well, just look at the fact that I got elected this year. I mean, I've told you to your face for the last 6 years, it ain't ever going to happen. And look at Jennifer Renee Poole, who was elected president of the caucus. And I knew that would never happen. I just didn't ever think the caucus would come around. And yet now it's the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender political caucus. So, you know, anytime somebody complains, as far as I'm concerned, they just volunteered.
Right. Right. And certainly, Ray, you know about that. I mean, you've gotten to many organizations that you helped out between knowing other people, between knowing what worked in some other organizations.
I was, I was with GLPC for a long time, for about 10 years. I was the COPAC chair with Jay Seegers, and I wanted to have a mock screening. And people would donate money, and they tell me that it wouldn't make money, that it wouldn't happen. Well, if I could bring you the list of people that showed up at that mock screening, it was just amazing. Then we had to find time to screen them and show people how to screen the candidates, from constable to city council to Sylvia Garcia, all of those. Yeah.
Well, and that's a really interesting point, because all three of us are very much know how the screening process works at the caucus. Mm-hmm. And I certainly inherit it. You inherit it. And Phyllis, you were probably around there at the beginning.
I was very early in the screening process, and it was really neat. You know, you just said you've got to be a member of an activist organization. I screened lots of political candidates and judges and everything else. And then when I became a lawyer and started practicing law, I went down to the courthouse. Some of these judges already knew me.
Right.
They already knew I was.
Right.
They already knew what my issue was. And so they started giving me work. And
right.
How else are you going to integrate yourself if you don't come out and get active?
Well, and you were also instrumental in changing HRC's policy of not really inclusiveness.
Yes, I really was. It was a the battle really began in the spring of 1995, because we had the language for an inclusive federal end of bill, and Senator Jim Jeffords was going to introduce it for us, and HRC got to him, and we found out about that in the summer, in June of 1995, at the ICLEP conference, the International Conference on Transgender Law and Employment Policy, which I founded, and it's because there was no transgender law. And with the exception of three leaders, national transgender leaders, with the exception of three, and that's because they had something that they couldn't get out of, every single national transgender leader was at the conference that year, and we were all in a room kind of thinking about what are we going to do after Enda's introduced, when we suddenly got the word that we'd been screwed. I can say that on radio. And you never saw such a marshalling of energy, because we were already all together in one room. And we blitzed HRC, and it was September when they paid for and invited a dozen of us to come to their headquarters to see what you know they could do, and they were going to convince us, and we said no. And just 2 months later, at the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force Creating Change, which is our national conference.
Well, actually, that's the NGLTF national conference.
I'm sorry, I thought that's what I said. Creating Change.
Oh, left out the name.
Yes, that's not HRC.
No.
Okay.
National Gay Lesbian Task Force. That's what I meant to say.
Okay.
That's their thing. I was introduced as helping to bring the entire gay and lesbian community to its knees. And I was given one of their Creators of Change Award, you know, which is really big deal.
Yes, yes.
Big deal. And we just continued to fight for 10 years. Recently, I've been told by Mara Kiesling, who is our lobbyist in Washington, D.C., with the National Center for Transgender Equality, that HRC has agreed to include transgenders in the next end of bill, and they're fighting for that. They're fighting with members of Congress.
Right.
To ensure that happens, which is, you know, very exciting and very gratifying.
Yes, absolutely. So, yes, there's always challenges that have to be made. Well, great. I am so proud that both of you have been elected by the community to be the Grand Marshals of the Pride 2006. And this Saturday, starting at 8:45 p.m., you'll both be on our float, the Pride float, as our guest, leading the parade with about 200,000 people cheering you on. And that's I'm just so proud of that honor. I'm proud that I am able to help make that statement, or make that podium for you all, because of all the hard work that you've done.
Now, doesn't the parade start at 8?
8:45.
I thought it started at 8.
No, because it doesn't get dark until it starts getting dark at 8:30 p.m., in case people don't know.
Okay.
And before that, starting at 2 p.m., the festival starts. And this is really our second year, and in fact, it's more than doubled its size this year, that the festival has really, you know, which we're really trying to make it come on to its own entity. So all day Saturday, there will be Pride stuff going on in Lower Westheimer. And yes, you'll be there.
I'll be in the John Kellett Foundation tent.
The history
and
tent.
I'll be in a living exhibit with the archives from MCCR.
Yes, and I'm real proud of that. Eric Olachek has worked on that along with MCCR that we got to know our history.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at 10, I'm going to be helping the Transgender Unity Committee put their float together, and then I'll be at the bank at the brunch at 11. I'm going to be floating around at the festival most of the day. For those of y'all who've never been to a parade, I must tell you that there is so much to see. That it usually takes 2.5 hours from the time the first float or marching unit starts until the last one passes by. And it is just like something you haven't ever seen before. I don't care if you've been to Macy's Parade in New York City or if you've been to St. Patrick's Day in Boston or anything. This is a big
mm-hmm.
parade, and it just goes on and on and on and on. And if you find it too crowded at Westheimer and Montrose, go a couple of blocks east or go a couple of miles west, because it starts at Woodhead.
Mm-hmm.
And the times that I've ridden, the times that I've marched, or the times that I've watched, between Woodhead and Dunleavy, it's only 2 or 3 people deep.
Right.
And so you can see it a lot easier. Once you get to the bend, it starts getting 12 or 2 dozen deep.
Right.
But it's
right.
really, really, really exciting. And another fun thing to do is to show up around 7:30 at the staging area where everybody who's going to be marching are putting their floats together, which is in the Woodhead area, because then you can go by and visit all your friends mm-hmm. before it starts.
Now, you can't drive down there. You
no,
can
but you can walk. Right.
Yes.
And I always do that.
Uh-huh. Jack, I also remember being parade co-chair with the Pride Committee, and you know as well as I did that we helped to have clean up that parade, and sometimes some people in the community didn't like it, but we had to clean it up so it would be family friendly.
Yes,
and,
yes,
absolutely.
But all of our segments of our community is involved in the parade.
Exactly.
And mm-hmm. we don't discriminate against anybody.
No.
As long as they follow the rules.
Exactly.
Keeping legal, that the parade is open to everybody, every mm-hmm. segment of our community. In fact, this year, one of the groups that are going to be marching in the parade is the Conroe GLSA group, which
That's
is the high
wonderful.
School
wow.
Gay, Lesbian, Straight Alliance.
Wow.
And I'm really proud of that.
That's wonderful.
Well, yeah. and I must say that last year I watched the parade, and I saw quite a few parents with children,
mm-hmm.
and they were just having a fun time. They were collecting Mardi Gras beads, you know, and it was really neat when the floats go by or the marching units go by.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of fun.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming by tonight. We were concerned about the weather, but the weather held out for us, and it usually holds out for us for the parade.
Yes,
it has for 27 years so far. So congratulations on being elected Grand Marshal, and we will see you Saturday night. So we'll see you Saturday and Saturday night
yes.
at both the festival and the parade. Again, Phyllis Fry and Ray Ramirez, you're listening to Queer Voices.
Thank you.
Confusion, yeah. I'm gonna break all out tonight. I'm gonna look the moon in the eye. I'm gonna blow the wind and nowhere left to hide. Oh, what should I do? Where should I go? I'm telling you, I just don't know. And baby, I gotta walk away. Ain't gonna stick around. I'm slowing down. I'm falling fast. I'm on the ground. And baby, from
comes. La 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 la, yeah yeah. It's a pretty place, but storm clouds are creeping in, pretending with a smile from ear to ear. But it won't take long till they're creeping out of here, yeah. I'm gonna break on out tonight. I'm gonna look the moon in the eye. I'm gonna blow with the wind and nowhere left to hide. And this is JD, and that was Jeff Straker. I said Straker, not Striker. He's a Canadian artist I met in New York this past week with a very good CD called Songs from Highway 15.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Valensky, Joan Devlin, JD Doyle, and Glenn Holt.
Welcome to our second hour of Queer Voices tonight. It's you're listening to KPFT Houston at 90.1 and 89.5 in Galveston. And this is definitely the Pride edition of Queer Voices, as this week is the final week of Pride for 2006. Of course, anchoring the Pride celebration this year is the Pride Festival, which happens at on Saturday, the 24th at 2 p.m. And the Pride Parade that starts just as it gets dark at 8:45 p.m. and lasts till about 11:30 in the evening. It is really a lot of fun, and with us this evening is Carol Wyatt, who is Vice President of the Board of Pride Houston, which is a nonprofit organization, and under full disclosure, I am Executive Director, just so that, you know, we are pushing this, but this is basically a community event. Carol, how did you get involved in Pride?
I sort of got suckered in. And by the way, hi and welcome. Thanks for letting me join you guys tonight. I had I do an annual charity party at my house, and one year some friends who were involved with Pride asked me to make Pride the charity beneficiary for that year, and I was happy to do so. I think it was y'all's, 25th anniversary a couple of years ago? Yeah. And so little did I know that I was just going to get sucked in after that point. So they asked me to be a judge for the next couple of years. What a total hoot that was, getting to sit on the stage and see all the performances and It just was a great time, and then I was asked to be on the board after that, and it's pretty much been downhill after that.
Well, and it's really interesting because you told us that you were never really on boards or got involved in committees.
Yeah, I really pretty much hate committee work. I haven't figured out how my life took this turn, but I got to tell you that I really have thoroughly enjoyed my work with Pride for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's a very well-run organization. Yeah, we have our glitches every now and then, but for the most part, very spot on, very fiscally responsible and accountable. And I understand that that's not always the case in the gay community, either here or around the country.
Or in nonprofits.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Let's make a sweeping generalization. But also, I really enjoy it because we bring such a diversity of people together to work, and bringing the men and the women of our community together is a particular passion of mine, so I enjoy that aspect of it.
And as we progressed, certainly you've seen some changes over the past couple years in the organization.
Well, certainly we try to get more professional every year. Our focus the last couple of years has been to rejuvenate and enliven the festival idea. I'm proud to say that I have seen every Pride parade. When was the start, Jack?
It was before my time here. 1978 was the first Pride celebration. 1979 was the first parade.
Okay, so I was there from the very beginning on the streets. I missed one when I went off to Colorado to have a commitment ceremony with an old girlfriend who's long gone by then. But I've made all but one of them and certainly have seen us grow and change over the years. The festival is our focus the last couple of years. The parade, I think, pretty much is... It's really strong. It runs on its own. It's the festival piece that we really wanted to beef up, particularly because we want the community to get exposure to the organizations and resources that are available in our community. And it's one thing to see them pass by on a float banging their rainbow tambourines, but it's a whole nother thing to be able to walk by them at a festival booth and actually get to visit with them.
Well, it's interesting. A friend of mine who is not involved in Pride at all said...
You have a friend who's not involved in Pride?
Yes, wow. Yes, yes. Hmm. It's strange, isn't it? But he's been very much involved in the community. He said that Pride is really the one thing that brings everybody together. And, you know, we're in a city where it's very spread out. I mean, very big metropolitan area. And people sometimes come to the bars, sometimes they don't. But really, it's just Pride that... everybody has to be at.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, there are tons of wonderful organizations in this community doing really important work and the heavy lifting in this community, but I can't think of another organization that really brings every group together, and that's a function that Pride provides. Now, I'll tell you that we're getting feedback that we need to do a better job in reaching out to some of the minority constituencies, the families, the people who live outside the loop. I mean, no matter how you slice and dice the demographic, we could always do a better job of reaching out and being inclusive. And for all of you listening out there in Radio Land tonight, I would invite you that if you're in a constituency that you feel like is not being well enough served by Pride Houston, please reach out to us. Let us know what you need, what you want, and by gosh, we'll do our best to help incorporate those things into our future plans.
Well, and exactly. A lot of times people said, well, why aren't you doing this or why aren't you doing that? And then we say, okay, well, how do we do that? And here's some of the tools that we have, but go on and do it. And
yeah.
The festival's a perfect example.
Yeah. You know, I'm a white 50-year-old fat girl. I don't know what a 20-year-old needs out of Pride. I don't know what somebody with a family living in Meyerland needs out of Pride. We need to hear from you guys so that we can always continue to be better.
So, this weekend is, of course, the big weekend with both the parade and the festival. And you've actually taken a section of Pride and really sort of helped develop it. And I guess maybe that's a way of building your friends list, isn't it?
Well, I claim to have friends because I'm involved with Friends of Pride. It looks good anyway. But one of the things we decided to do as Pride is we wanted to extend our reach throughout the community throughout the year and not just during the intense Pride season of June. And we will do more things in the future, but the first thing we've done is our Friends of Pride program. We're trying to do events throughout the year. For example, our first official event was the Sing-Along Show Tunes Brunch back in February, which was just a total hoot. And you'll see us do more things like that in the coming year, golf tournaments, whatever wacky things we can think of, maybe a non-competitive, I know you can't use the word Olympics, but a silly Olympics, an afternoon of silly fun field games, etc.
Okay, and I guess the best place to get information is going to the website, which is pridehouston.org, and also the Pride magazine is out.
Absolutely.
35,000 copies.
And it's gorgeous. It not only gives you lots of information about Pride Houston, but Pride in general around the country and around the world. I thought it was interesting to find out that Pride Houston is part of an international organization called InterPride, and that's every Pride group around the world that is producing Pride festivities. We went to their conference back in
October
in Minneapolis, and there were people from Iceland and help me out, Jack. I mean, Sri Lanka.
It's really incredible. Over the years, they've talked about this, that Pride organizations around the world, well, actually, if you back up in 1969 when the riots were, the Stonewall riots, that this would have developed into a worldwide celebration, that there are groups in almost every continent, not Antarctica, that celebrate Pride.
The
not
penguins are stubbornly heterosexual, apparently.
Right. Not
or
always
in the closet.
In June. And in some instances, it's maybe just a picnic. In some instances, their governments are very anti-gay, and for them to even speak out, they could get killed or put in jail. That this has happened, and it's really interesting. I mean, you know, certainly we know the New Yorks and the Los Angeles and San Francisco's, and even Houston has these big celebrations. But when somebody gets up there and says, well, we organized 100 people in, well, I think it was 10,000 people in Warsaw, Poland. I mean, the whole group gets up there and applauds, you know, because these people are risking their lives.
Yeah, and certainly a couple of weeks ago, the Moscow parade was in the news. The mayor was just horribly offensive in his statements, and the police came out. It was a very bad thing.
Yes, and we certainly have our trials and tribulations in this country, but certainly because of celebrating Pride since 1969, actually 1970 as the anniversary, that we've made a lot of change, positive changes in our community.
Yeah, you know, sometimes people come up to me and say, why the heck are you spending all your time just working on Pride? It's just a big old party and parade, right? And there's a story that came out last year that I think just really epitomizes it. To me, why it's important that we have a chance to get together in a very positive and celebratory way. Our president, Nick Brines, was walking along the parade route shortly before the parade started, and a young man approached him and said, I recognize your face from some of the publications. He said, I'm a student up at A&M. I live a very closeted life. I decided to come down here for the first time and try to experience this. I was scared to death to come, didn't know what to expect. And he said, I am just blown away to see all of these people so happy and comfortable in their skins. It changed my life tonight. And you hear a story like that every now and then, and it makes you willing to work out in the heat and make Pride happen for everybody.
Well, the famous Ray Hill story that I have repeated over and over again to a lot of the groups is that as you're going down the parade route, you know, you smile and show everybody how comfortable you are to be a GLBT person and part of this community, because there are people that are probably watching two blocks down who are not comfortable enough to be in the crowd.
Yeah.
Let them know that we do have this family and within our community. And we argue and we gossip and we do all these things as a community does, because we're family. And sometimes we don't agree with each other. But the underlying of all this is that, you know, we are a community and that we work together and we've been through through some incredibly tough times with AIDS, with discrimination, with the fact that this government really wants no part of us in many ways.
Really? Who knew?
You know, the fact that they would kick people out of the military who are experts in certain areas, you know, that they don't need us.
Right.
And suffer the consequences is just pretty incredible. But yet, you know, we still do have a community that works together and that tries to make it a better world for everybody.
Right. And I'd like to give a little challenge out to everybody who's listening today. If you're looking for a way to get involved or to meet new people or just become more assimilated into Houston, joining an organization is a great way to do that. The bars not all that often result in the positive kinds of relationships that you might want. And we'd love to have you at Pride Houston. We work our hineys off. Is hiney a radio word? Okay. But whether Pride Houston floats your boat or some other organization, there are tons of things going on in this community, from gay gardeners to crocheters to athletes. Find some way to get involved.
And you know,
I'm down off my soapbox now. But
yes, well, actually, as you say that, one of the things that the festival is going to have this year, again this year, is a community tent, which hosts about 30 different organizations throughout the community. And that is being sponsored by the Bunnies organization.
Bunnies on the Bayou.
Bunnies on the Bayou, which generously donated the most expenses for that so that we can charge almost nothing to the nonprofit organizations. So there will be organizations there like the Community Center. And Bunnies, of course, will be there. But that's a good way to, you know, sort of get a little sample of all the different organizations and say, well, maybe I'm interested in this or maybe I'm interested in that.
Yeah.
And, you know, besides that, the other thing that the festival is going to be featuring this year is a history tent that gives us a little bit of reflection of what our community was like years ago. And that, by the John Kellett Foundation being sponsored, is featuring the archives of MCCR Church,
right.
Which is not just the church archives, but it's a lot of the community archives.
You know, a lot of people don't even understand why we hold Pride in June. It may look pretty stupid to hold it in June, living in Houston with as hot as it is, but of course it was the commemoration of the anniversary of the Stonewall riots in New York City, when the drag queens finally had enough and fought back. I personally wish they had fought back in October instead of June, but that's just me. But, you know, we've talked about the serious parts of the festival, but there's an awful lot of fun that's going to go on at the festival, too. Booths for food and drink and family area, two stages of live entertainment going on during the day, headlined by Taylor Dane. So lots of fun in advance of the parade itself, which is just a total extravaganza.
And if you want some more information about Pride Houston, you can go to the website, pridehouston.org, or call the Pride Line at 713-529-6979. But the website really has the most comprehensive amount of information.
Jack is only saying that because he has to answer the phone,
right.
So he really wants you to go to the website.
Yes. Sometimes it gets a little bit difficult when it gets to the third line trying to answer that. But actually, I am very, very fortunate because we have this incredible volunteer force. And in fact, some people take their vacation time around this time of year to help out in the Pride office. So I'm not lonely in the Pride office. And in fact, if you have extra time, you can get involved either this year or next year. And our next meeting after this is the second Tuesday in July at the Metropolitan Multipurpose Center. It's really going to be more of a debriefing meeting of what went right and what we can improve on and stuff like that. That happens at 7 p.m. on the second Tuesday of the month in July. But it's this weekend, which is the culmination of all the great things that have been happening. There's also some events that happened this week, and one of the events that's happening is the women will be singing highlights from Hollywood and Broadway, and that happens tomorrow, June 20th, at Bering Memorial Church, 1440 Herald. Tickets are very reasonably priced. And
can I jump in?
Yes.
They did a concert Saturday night, and it was quickly sold out, so they had to add a second performance. I talked to some of the people who were there Saturday. They said the women just rocked. So don't miss that concert.
And if you'd like some more information, you can call 713-521-SING or BayouCityPerformingArts.org. Carol Wyatt, Vice President of Pride Houston, Vice President of the Board, thank you very much for coming by, because I know you have a busy week this week.
As do we all, but, you know, we've really worked hard to put on a quality production for you guys this week, and we hope you all turn out, have a great time, and celebrate Pride. Thank you so much.
And I'd like to thank KPFT for also being a media sponsor for Pride this year, and you're listening to Queer Voices.
And again, the details on the Bayou City's Women's Chorus taking center stage. The women will be singing highlights from Hollywood and Broadway, as well as songs composed by female songwriters, and that's tomorrow night at 8 p.m. at Baring Memorial United Methodist Church. Tickets are on sale and can be purchased by calling 713-521-SING, that's 713-521-7464, or you can go online and order them at www.BayouCityPerformingArts.org, that's all one word, BayouCityPerformingArts.org. And now from the middle of the fertile cornfields of Iowa, here is Joan Devlin.
Hi, yes, this is Joan Devlin in the middle of the cornfields, as Glenn said. And tonight, in honor of it being not only Pride Month, but Gay History Month, we are going to be talking to David Schneer, who is one of the authors of American Queer Now and Then. Actually, author's not the right word, David, is it's more like editor, correct?
Exactly, editor.
Now, David, talk to us a little bit about this book, because American Queer Now and Then is very different from most gay history books.
I'm actually curious to hear why you think it's quite different. What did you get out of it that made you feel like it was quite different?
Because it basically took all different types of literature that people used to describe their gay identity and kind of melded it together. It's not like a traditional history book.
No, absolutely not. Actually, the impetus for this book that my colleague Karen Aviv and I put together was a class that we taught at the University of Denver, which is where I teach full-time. And she's a sociologist and I'm a historian, and we tried to figure out how to teach our students about the queer experience. And she approached it from a contemporary political sociological perspective, and I approached it from a historical perspective, and we tried to figure out how we could tell this comprehensive story together. And so what we decided to do is we divided up the class thematically, which is the way the book is divided up, and she covered each of the topics as it sort of plays out today in American society, and I talked about how it took shape over the 20th century to explain how we got to where we are today. That's how we developed the structure of the book that you have in your hands.
Now, how hard was it to get some of the material for the book, especially some of the older material?
Well, that's the fun part, at least for me as a historian, is finding the material that other people haven't read before. It was, for example, we have a piece from James Baldwin or a piece from the Kinsey Report. Those are things that are easy to find and that people have had some exposure to, but that we wanted to include in the book because they're classics. And you have to have space in a book like this for classics. But we also have, for example, an article from the first decade of the 20th century from a newspaper in St. Louis about, I think the way the newspaper article describes it is, basically, African-American men, although the language they used at the time was Negro men, and white men were cavorting together out by the levee near highway, whatever it was. And what was so interesting about the article is what upset the article writer was not that men were cavorting with one another, but that black men and white men were cavorting with one another. And you find little gems like this when you do historical research, and to me it's these kinds of things as important as the Kinsey Report that tell the history of queer experience in America.
Now, were there any surprises for you as you were putting this book together?
Absolutely, actually. We had to rethink a number of our assumptions that we went into this project thinking. One of the biggest was the idea that we have today of GLBT, and I've been listening to this radio program, and it's a pretty common acronym now for the queer community, and we use the word queer in the book for very particular reasons, but we have this assumption that GLBT means that gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgenders have some kind of common experience. And one of the things that we discovered is that throughout the 20th century, especially gay men and lesbians, since as communities those are the two groups of people that had had well-established communities through the 20th century is that they didn't actually interact that much with one another until certain moments in history, like World War II, when women got thrust into these women's auxiliary corps and men were put on ships together for the first time, or Stonewall, as we're commemorating with Pride Month this week. Stonewall is another example where men and women do actually intersect with one another, interact with one another, but those moments were actually the exception rather than the rule, and it forced us to really ask, is the gay male experience and the lesbian experience in America really the same? Does GLBT make sense historically? And that was actually something surprising to both of us, because we like to see ourselves both as scholars, writers, and activists, and a lesbian woman and a gay man working together to actually build an intellectual community of GLBT, or the word we use, queer people. And that hasn't been the way it's worked in the past.
What do you hope that people who read your book will take away from it?
It's a great question. We have, near the end, our biggest chapter, and it's more or less the conclusion, is our chapter on activism. And one of the discoveries or the conclusions we came to putting this book together, which made us happy, so to speak, and so it wasn't a surprise, was that the changes that have taken place through the 20th century and what's taking place now for queer people in America have happened because queer people have demanded change. So we made the last chapter in the book activism, because what we see as driving change in American history is activism. And so we play with this idea of liberation. And the gay liberation movement, which really got sparked in 1969 with Stonewall, we play with this idea that it actually takes people to do things and to speak out to actually create change. And the opening and the closing of the book are more or less in homage to the feminist lesbian writer Audre Lorde. And we use her essay about silence, transforming silence into action, as a call to all of our readers that sometimes it's scary and sometimes it's risky, but change doesn't happen unless you actually speak. And that's, if there's one thing we want from our readers to get from an activist point of view, it would be that.
Now, do you see your book, because when we're talking to David Schneer, editor, co-editor, along with Karen Aviv of American Queer Now and Then, and when I look at your book, when you go online and you Google, you know, American Queer Now and Then, in some places it's marketed as a history book. Mm-hmm. In some places it's marketed as a gay book.
Right.
Or a gay interest book. You know, I personally like to see it as a history book because I think this book is something that everybody, gay, straight, or in between, can take something away from.
Absolutely. I'm actually really pushing my American history colleagues to use this book in their American history classes. It will be used in gender studies classes, in queer studies classes, at least we hope it will be used, if people actually like it. But for me, I'm going to be incredibly proud when the first person teaching a survey of 20th century American history includes this book. And the argument, I have to tell people, why would we pick this book over, say, a book about race relations through the 20th century? And my easy answer would be, well, you should include that one, too. But this test case really is about how a minority has gone from being invisible to visible over the course of the 20th century, which makes it very different from, say, African Americans, who were always marked as visibly other in American society. So we actually see how groups can become activists and can choose to become activists when they want to be. So it's an interesting test case, and that's my marketing attempt to get U.S. historians to use the book.
Now, what would you say to those people who kind of say things like, well, we don't have it as bad as, you know, those guys at the turn of the century. We don't have it as bad as people in the 50s. I mean, you know, what would you tell those people?
Well, first I would say, have you asked the people who lived at the turn of the century if they would agree with what you just said? I'm the historian, remember. So the difference between the way I approach these questions and the way Karen approached them is, for me as a historian, I want to know what the experience of the person at the turn of the century was on their terms. In other words, did someone living in New York in the Bowery in 1905 think of him or herself as an oppressed person needing liberation, the way we probably think they thought? And it's not clear that they did. Their way of thinking would have been very different back then. The 50s, it's actually a little bit clear that the things were pretty crappy in the 1950s, because the 1940s and wartime had actually been a moment of gay social expression and cultural expression that got repressed along with lots of other things, in the 1950s. But one of the things that I, as a historian, like to teach people is that history is not a linear progression towards utopia, towards a perfect future. Are things better now? Well, things are certainly different now. The idea of the queer family didn't exist 50 years ago, although I like to remind people that gay men and lesbians were still parenting, just not as openly queer families as we know them today. That's different, and at least from my perspective, living in a gay family or a queer family, I would say that's better. But there are a lot of ways where things aren't better. So, that, I mean, if to answer your question in a nutshell, no, things are not always getting better.
What would you say to people that are still in the closet?
Well, actually, what I would say to them is I can't be the one to tell you when to come out or to whom to come out. And I also would tell anyone who is still in the closet that coming out is a constant process. It's not a moment that takes place in time. In the last chapter of the book, we talk about the outing campaigns that took place in the late 80s and early 90s when some queer activists took it upon themselves to try to force change by outing public officials who may have had some power and some influence. And we ask, sort of, what does this do to people when you're forcing identities on them in some ways? I would never want to force an identity on someone. I would never want to force someone to come out. For example, I spent a lot of time in Russia, and when I talk to my Russian gay friends about what's going on in the United States, they actually have a very hard time relating to it, because for them, their worlds are not about whether you are out or not, but it's about who are you queer to. In your work setting, you're probably not queer. Among your close friends, you're incredibly queer. Family, for the most part, they're not queer. So we would call that living in the closet, but the way in our book we phrase it, and this is a term we take from an African-American intellectual, W.E.B. Du Bois, that they're living with double consciousness, that you have various personas that you take on over time. So someone living in the closet today, I would encourage them to find the bravery to be able to come out, but in his or her own way and time.
Now, how can people get the book, American Queer, Now and Then?
From your independent bookseller. That's the first place I would have you check. And if they don't have it, you can always order it. I mean, it's widely available online in through the publisher, which is Paradigm Publishers, which I want to give a plug to them because they actually approached us about doing this book. We didn't approach them. It's a rare publishing house that actually takes risks and tries to do cutting-edge things. And this publishing house really did it, not knowing if it would be a commercial success. So I hope it is mostly to prove to the publishing world that these kinds of books can actually do well. So it's pretty widely available, but I always recommend people go to their independent bookstore first.
And how has the book been selling so far? Actually, when did it come out, and how has it been doing up till now?
It came out pretty recently. It came out in April, and I actually do not know how it's been doing. I try not to constantly pester the editors for sales numbers because, well, it bugs them, and it's usually not increasing as quickly as I would like it to be. So I actually don't know how well it's been doing. The real litmus test for a book like this will be when, say, an American history class at I don't know, the University of Houston puts it on their syllabus. That's, frankly, more than sales numbers. It'll be including the book on a syllabus like that will to me mean that the book has been a success.
That, yeah, I was thinking that too, because as I was reading and I was just thinking, boy, I wish, you know, when I was in school we had history books like this.
Me too. I am not young, but I'm also not old. I was at Berkeley in the early 90s as an undergraduate, and we didn't have books like this on our bookshelf. We had lots of great feminist literature. I want to really mark that the 80s were this wonderful flowering of great feminist and lesbian feminist literature. But we didn't have a comprehensive book that felt like something that you would read in your U.S. history class. Let me put it that way, because writers like Audre Lorde and Gloria Ansel Duo were not being read in U.S. history classes. And my guess is they're probably still not being read in U.S. history classes, even though they should be.
Well, great. Well, David, I want to thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Joan, it's my pleasure. I really appreciate the time.
We've been talking to David Schneer, who, along with Karen Aviv, has edited a book called American Queer, Now and Then. This is not like any history book you've ever read in your life. It is absolutely amazing. David, thank you again for being on our show. The book is available online and through your independent bookseller. It's published by Paradigm Press, and you're listening to Queer Voices.
Pride, pride, gotta have pride. It's been around too long to keep it inside. Pride, can't sit back and watch from the side. Pride is power and power is pride. It's time to celebrate all the colors of the rainbow. Get out into the streets, follow the tide. Pride.
Between 2.5 and 3 million people clogged downtown Sao Paulo, Brazil on June 17th for what was probably the largest LGBT pride parade on the planet. It's that time of year, of course, but such public displays were unthinkable before the last weekend of June in 1969. It was illegal to serve alcohol to homosexuals or for two men to dance together in many cities then. Lesbian-gay bars were often run by organized crime, drink prices were inflated, and police raids and subsequent public ruination were routine. All that changed when the queer patrons of the Stonewall Inn on Christopher Street in New York City's Greenwich Village finally had enough.
And festivals celebrating gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender pride are now held in cities all over the world practically all year round, but the tradition was born in June. Unfortunately, it's not surprising to discover that many people, even those who come out to enjoy the celebrations, don't know what event they're commemorating.
Do you know what the Stonewall riots were about?
I never have read about it, what exactly happened there, the purpose of it.
I've never heard anything about it. No, I don't know nothing about it.
So just what is this party all about? The significance of June 27, 1969 must be seen against the backdrop of life before that. A poem by Judy Gron from the classic Lesbian Concentrate album gives you some idea.
A history of lesbianism. How they came into the world. The women loving women came in 3 by 3 and 4 by 4. The women loving women came in 10 by 10. And 10 by 10 again, until there were more than you could count. How they lived in the world, the women-loving women learned as much as they were allowed, and walked and wore their clothes the way they liked, whenever they could. They did whatever they knew to be happy or free, and worked and worked and worked. The women-loving women in America were called dykes, and some liked it, and some did not. They made love to each other, the best they knew how, and for the best reasons. How they went out of the world, the women-loving women went out one by one, having withstood greater and lesser trials, and much hatred from other people. They went out one by one, each having tried in her own way to overthrow the rule of men over women. They tried it one by one, and hundred by hundred, until each came in her own way to the end of her life and died. The subject of lesbianism is very ordinary. It's the question of male domination that makes everybody angry.
By the late 1960s, the anger of lesbians and gays was straining the locks on the closet doors, but something still held them back. This discussion was recorded at Pacifica Radio New York just 6 months before the historic event.
This is the New Symposium, a program from and for the homosexual community. I'm Barrett Searles, and also on hand,
Kermit Lamb.
I have felt, and I think I've changed even my thinking on this in the last 3 or 4 years, is that homosexuals aren't proud enough to be homosexuals and get out and you know, be militant a little bit and say I am, and a little like I'm glad to see now in the racial thing that Negroes now aren't just trying to get along with everybody else. They've seen beauty in their own blackness.
Yeah.
Black is beautiful.
It bears on what you're saying about being proud of homosexual, which I think even at now is a little much to ask of most people, but just being open about it. Since doing this program, and kind of because of doing this program and trying to find people to do this program back at the beginning, it has come so sharply to my attention the total lack of courage that the homosexual community has. And I know the reasons, damn it, and I've been through it myself. I think that is one thing you can really pin on all of you out there is cowardice. I know I'm going to get letters saying, okay, it's easy for you. You're not going to get fired from the station. But it hasn't been that easy. The feeling that I've totally lost contact with my father because of this program. Mm. And I know that people's lives can be ruined if they open up and reveal themselves. On an idealistic plane, we all know that if every homosexual said what he was tomorrow, that the whole situation would be changed for the better. Now, this is obviously a pipe dream. But for every homosexual that does open up and reveal himself, there are that many more people that realize that homosexuals are real, breathing human beings. They are not sex maniacs or freaks. That many more young people that are given the fact that a homosexual life needn't be a disaster.
I know a number of people who are under 25, say, under 20. They all seem to be much more relaxed. I hope it's a sign. I don't.
So do I.
There's a certain feeling among many younger people of not caring who knows. They have straight friends who know, and I hope this is sort of indicative of something.
June 27th, 1969, as recalled in Brett Artery's 1970 documentary.
The disorders began with a routine police raid on a homosexual bar, the Stonewall, on Christopher Street. Almost every homosexual who was in New York at the time of the Stonewall Rebellion has his own private memory of what took place. One of the longtime leaders of the gay rights movement, Craig Rodwell, remembers it this way.
The first night was Friday. I was on the way home from a friend's house. The raid was just starting at that time, and we noticed the crowd. We went over there, and a crowd was gathering out in front. There was a paddy wagon pulled up and a few people being taken out. It started with those few coins and pebbles being thrown at the police, and then the police retreated into the Stonewall. And then after the police barricaded themselves inside, it was like half an hour later, the riot police started moving up Christopher, breaking up the crowd, which had really become a very angry crowd with hundreds of bottles and rocks. There wasn't one window left in the whole place after about 10 minutes. And they broke the crowd up into small groups, and this went on for like 2 or 3 hours, back and forth in the whole area. I mean, they thought the people would just go home or run, especially since they were gay people. They're not used to gay people standing up at all, especially in front of police. But they would chase people away, and then they'd go around the block and come in another way. And this sort of tug of war went on all evening. And then on Saturday night, it was much the same thing. Starting about 9, crowds started to gather in the area. And then around 11 or 12, they started taking over the street, stopping cars from coming through, unless there were gay people in them. Two fires were set. But generally, there's an angry mood, a lot of chanting, a lot of hand-holding, a lot of assertion of being gay. There's a way of saying we're tired of hiding, tired of leading two lives, tired of denying our basic identity, denying ourselves. Newfound pride, really, a collective pride in their identity.
Another important outgrowth of the riots was the formation of numerous action-oriented homosexual groups in New York and around the country. They're composed, for the most part, of younger and more militant homosexuals.
It still is a relatively small minority of gay people who do reflect this new spirit, whatever you want to call it. But I think it's going to infect the masses of gay people in the coming years.
Here to stay, and nobody is going to ignore us any longer.
Hey Joe, get up and go. Wouldn't like to
This is Gabrielle Antolovich reporting from West Hollywood for This Way Out. Do you know what the Stonewall riots were about?
I know a little bit about them.
What do you know?
Oh, some cops came into a bar and some Long Beach cops and
New York.
Oh, New York. Okay. Well, anyway, whatever city. But anyway, they came into the bar and they were trying to break up the gays or whatever. And then the gays kicked their butt. That's what I heard.
I just heard like a whole bunch of drag queens just sort of like, you know, barricaded the whole half of the city and just, you know, took over for about a few days.
You know that it wasn't just drag queens. It was leather boys and lesbians and people of color, too.
Yeah.
You know anything about the Stonewall riots?
I don't know a thing about them.
Well, what's the gay parade about?
I guess to celebrate the gay life.
Where you can touch in public and it doesn't, I guess, offend anybody, or you can just be yourself. You know that it's a yearly event to commemorate the Stonewall riots that happened in New York.
No! Did you know that?
No, I knew it was Stonewall, but I didn't know why they called it that.
Maybe I don't know enough about my culture.
Place. To get in, they had to know your face.
of those cops and all around.
Feeling rage, cops hid in the very bar they were supposed to rent.
Crowd smashed down the door, fire spread across the floor.
3 days later, peace was restored. Kids just sprung up by the doors. History rap.
Maybe I don't know enough about my culture.
Sex and discos instead of rights.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. This week, Christopher Gall, Lucia Chappell, Rex Walkner, Bill Kelly, Graham Underhill, and Gabrielle Antolovich contributed program material. You heard music by John Gilbert Levitt, the Berkeley Women's Music Collective, the Tom Robinson Band, and Age of Consent. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can now listen online to This Way Out exclusively at outinamerica.com. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. We thank you. Log on to our website to see how you can help keep this program on the air. That's thiswayout.org. To sign up for our weekly emailed program information messages and or our occasional This Way Out updates, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038 USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on WREK Atlanta, Georgia, 2BBB Bellingen, New South Wales, KBRP Bisbee, Arizona, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Everybody stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
Well, this is the Pride Show, as we were talking about, and I've sort of taken a little bit of personal privilege being part of this show for the past, or being part of KPFT for the past 24 years. Back about a month ago, I missed the show, and I've been away because of the Pride thing, but the first week I missed the show is because my father passed. And he passed, and it's actually, unfortunately, it's best for the circumstances, because he was sick for quite a while. I actually got up and gave a little bit of a speech during the funeral, which was very sort of tense for me, because even though I'm privileged to be able to talk on the radio or talk to crowds about Pride and community events, this was a little bit different, actually talking to the family about, and even though I'm pretty open about who and what I am, it's still parts of the family don't know, because I have been away for approximately 30 years. But I certainly did learn a few things of being away from the family and not talking to them, and it sort of brings me back here. Pride has been part of my life for many, many years, and I'm very proud of some of the things that we've done, not just me, but many of the volunteers. This year we should have a really good celebration. Of course, the only thing that we really are concerned about right now is the weather, because most of the other stuff is done. It's sort of, as a person who works there, it's sort of like, okay, it's on autopilot, it's downhill, and most of the work is done. Now we're just waiting for the event. And it's not only the people that in the organization, the many volunteers who I can't thank enough. Pride isn't just about me. I mean, I work there full time, but it's really about the people who spend their spare time, their hours, their vacation time putting this all together, which is just an incredible amount of sacrifice that people take, because they really passionately believe in what's going on. And it's not just Pride Houston. It is the many, many organizations which make up this community. Such organizations as the Counseling Center, the Montrose Counseling Center, Legacy, a lot of the smaller organizations that don't have full-time people, who are all part of this event, either being in the parade, being part of the festival, putting on events, and that's really what brings this entire community together. People sacrificing the time and the money. People put a lot of money into this of their own personal money because they believe in it. If you're interested in what events are still happening and before the end of the week, you can go to the website, pridehouston.org, under celebration, under events. There's been a number of events. There continues to be a number of events. It also takes money to put this on. A lot of people have raised money through different organizations or spending their own money to put things together. The people who do the floats in the parade, that certainly doesn't come easily. They work on it. Some are lucky enough to be able to afford buying a professional float, but a lot of people sort of put their own contingents together. Between the buying the beads, that's something that has really become a Houston pride tradition, is the fact that we can throw beads in our parade, that our floats light up. And one of the things in the festival that I said earlier is the fact that we have all these nonprofits that are being sponsored by the Bunnies on the Bayou organization, bunnies.org on the website. They're going to be handing out their proceeds from the bunny party at the festival this year. The scheduled events should be up on the website shortly if it's not there already. It's pretty amazing because it takes probably this year about 150 different people who volunteer. Some people will just show up on the day of the event. Some people work year-round. And that happens to in many of the other organizations also, that they work year-round to either put on their event or put together what happens on stage. And then there's a lot of entertainment. And certainly I got to thank J.D. Doyle for all the work he's put in helping promote GLBT performers. And yes, we get a headline act, but we also do try to put some of the local GLBT performers on the community stage here at Pride. And we try to keep the process open as much as possible. The fact that I was telling you earlier that the Grand Marshals are elected by the community. The judges are people from the community, not people from Pride, that will be judging the event. Nobody will be riding as a guest in a convertible from the Pride organization in the parade. We'll all be working that day. And it's part of the things that we do. And basically, Pride is sort of the producer of the event, but it's actually the units and the individual entries that are sort of the star of it. But it's all done for the people who watch the parade, either live there or watch it on the news or buy the DVD later to see what it was all about. It's really an event that is put on by the entire community. And I'm very proud to have been part of it and continue to be part of it, this organization, and part of the many other organizations in the community, such as the GLBT Community Center, which is going to be at the festival, or the Caucus, or HERA, which is the Houston Equal Rights Alliance. They're going to be registering voters. You know, it's a pretty sad thought that when you look at the community, that a lot of us don't even go out and vote. And we're all talking about trying to move forward and do some social change. But if we're not out there getting involved, we're not out there voting, we're not part of some civil rights organization, how can this community progress? Certainly, you look at things like Will and Grace. Yes, it's on primetime television. It's just ended. It's run, but what does that really say about who and what we are? It's more of a, oh, well, let's just make fun about this or that, but there's a lot more to the community. Definitely a show like Sex and the City had more to say about the GLBT community than Will and Grace. And you have to sort of look at the alternative community. Certainly KPFT has been a supporter, has opened up its airwaves to this community, and many of the other organizations that we have that do that. We have a voice, and we only have a voice because people get involved. Certainly I want to thank all of our guests tonight, our two Grand Marshals, which is Ray Ramirez and Phyllis Fry, who joined us earlier, Julie Oliver, who is in HPD going through transitioning, and I want to thank Carol Wyatt, the Vice President of Pride Houston, and Joan Devlin, interviewing the authors of Queer American Queer Now and Then. Next week, J.D. Doyle's doing Queer Music Heritage, which is basically bits and pieces or things that he's left out in other shows, and we'll be doing a wrap-up of Pride in the first hour. So thank you very much for joining us. On behalf of the entire collective here on Queer Voices, we wish you the best Pride.
listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Networks station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles, and J.D. Doyle's Queer Music Heritage, which is produced in Houston. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Joan Devlin, J.D. Doyle, Glenn Holt, and Jack Valensky. For more information about tonight's program, including links to websites and organizations mentioned during the show, visit queervoices.org. And you can send email to jack@queervoices.org. Be sure to listen to KPFT every Sunday morning starting at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. And don't forget to volunteer for Q Patrol, a nonprofit corporation running citizens' watch patrols in the Montrose to prevent hate crimes. It's fun, safe, and easy to do. Just call 713-528-SAFE. At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston, a Pacifica Foundation station. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
The people of Cuba have suffered under a material aid embargo imposed by the United States for over a half century. The Cuba Solidarity Committee of Houston has fully supported the challenge of this blockade by supplying material aid, financial donations, and logistical support through the Pastors for Peace annual caravan to Cuba. The caravan arrives in Houston July 1st, and we need your donations. The caravan primarily focuses on delivering medical and educational supplies. Monetary donations are also urgently needed. Checks can be made out to Pastors for Peace. Donations can be dropped off at KPFT, Shrine of the Black Madonna, Shape Community Center, the First Unitarian Church. Please join us. Please donate. For more information, call 281-756-9663 or 832-860-6464. This is KPFT.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.